Yeah. It's Mr. Anchor. Fantasy Sports and Politics Crew. Yeah. Check. Fantasy Sports and Politics. Ain't no other talk show hot as this. Cover every sport and we get it all right. Log on the site, you can listen tonight. Talk about the game, who in first place. You can even call up, state your own case. Football, b-ball, soccer too. Log on, ain't nobody stopping you. It's Fantasy Sports and Politics Crew. Yeah, come on. Fantasy Sports and Politics Crew. Yeah. Fantasy Sports and Politics Crew. Fantasy Sports and Politics Crew. Yeah, log on. Peace.
You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game. You don't play to just play it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again. You know what time it is, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the East Coast, as I say. I am JT, a.k.a. The Master, and as always, and always a pleasure, I am joined by my esteemed co-host, the man from Jersey, just like myself, Jeff the Joker. And as always, we engage in conversation and give you information about the crazy world. The wacky world and the fun-filled world of fantasy sports and politics. And if you hear all that, then you know you're with the FSP crew and the FSP crew show. Got a great show in store for you today. The number to call in is 347-637-3220. 347-637-3220. And as always, that's the place to be if you want to talk to either Jeff or me. And it's always sponsored by the Fantasy Sportsbook and Casino.com website where players win and winners play. Like I said, we got a great show in store for you tonight, mostly because training camps have been opening up left and right all through this week, and it's going to be throughout the weekend. We're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, and that's football. But not necessarily about training camp, but about other things that are happening in the football world. But before we get to that, let's bring in my esteemed co-host, the man from Jersey, just like myself. Welcome, Jeff. How you be?
Hey, how's it going, Jerry?
It's going. It's not going yet, but it's going. Anyway, without further ado, Jeff, there's been a lot of things going on in the last few days, in the last few hours, for that fact, within the last 24 hours. Let's get to one of them. And, you know, I really was thinking about how I was going, wanted to start the show off and who I wanted to start it off with. And I'll have to start it off with this guy here because this guy is well-respected throughout the league without a doubt, okay? I'm talking about Pat Bowlen, the owner of the Denver Broncos, six-time participant in the Super Bowl, two-time winner with the GM of the Broncos, John Elway, and steps down, says he has Alzheimer's disease. Now, I knew about this at least a couple years ago, that he was had the beginning stages of Alzheimer's, and it must got to a certain state that dementia is beginning to rob him of some of his fondest memories over the past few years of the Denver Broncos. So his absence from the facility on Wednesday, as players reported for physicals on the eve of training camp, was as jarring as the announcement that the 70-year-old Bowlen was giving up control of the team because of Alzheimer's disease. I have an audio that I want to play that a choked-up John Elway because he's known Pat Bowlen ever since he's been with the Broncos, and have formed a pretty close relationship, from what I gather, with him. So let's play this clip, and then hear that familiar sound there, Jeff.
yeah, it wouldn't be a show unless you heard that sound.
Anyway, let me play this clip of a choked up John Elway, and then we'll talk about Pat Bowlen stepping down and relinquishing the ownership.
First and foremost, team president Joe Ellis will now take over and says little will change in the day-to-day operations of the team. The hard part now, though, moving forward, is going through those day-to-day operations without Pat Bowlen.
This place will never be the same.
Through glassy eyes and staggered speech.
It's difficult to sit in front of you today and talk about this.
Broncos leaders trying to put into words today.
A day of terrific sadness for... Tremendous sadness.
What it means to go to work without Pat Bowlen.
It's going to be very hard to not see him walk through those front doors every day.
An iconic owner in the NFL for the past 30 years, Bowlen's winning tradition speaks for itself.
6 Super Bowl appearances, 2 Lombardi trophies, 300 wins in 30 years.
Bowlen proved to have a winning personality as well. Longtime columnist Woody Page has known Pat Bowlen for the past 30 years.
And so he had to learn Colorado. And the first thing he learned, which Joe Ellis has pointed out over and over again, is that the Broncos are a public trust. They go beyond Pat Bowlen owning the team. They go beyond John Elway.
Moving forward, Bowlen has placed his Broncos ownership in the Pat Bowlen Trust that is controlled by non-family members. Final say, authority with the team is held by Joe Ellis.
He wants us to win. He's always wanted that, and he'll continue to want that.
Our goal is to continue to put the successful football teams on the field that we have and run it the way that Pat Bowlen would want this team run.
Bowlen's long-term goal is for one of his 7 children to run the team, but only when they are ready to do so. Nick Griffith, Fox 31.
Some raw emotion team from John Elway. Nick, thanks.
Team president Joe Ellis pledged to continue Bowlen's legacy and winning culture. He forced it during his long stewardship of the franchise. Ellis is adding the title of CEO and will have the final say on all matters. Just like you heard at the end of that clip, Jeff, Joe Ellis has been entrusted to take care of the day-to-day operations as the CEO of the Broncos until... one of the kids of Pat Bowlen is in quotes ready to take their spot that their father built. Your thoughts, Pat Bowlen. Now,
you know,
before you speak, Pat Bowlen is one of the classiest owners in the NFL, and as broken up as these guys must be, it must be pretty bad in the mental state that he is right now. Talk to me.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. He's owned the team for a long time. He was very successful as a businessman and as an NFL owner. And I guess the only positive is that his condition it could help others because of publicity. This is something, it's very unfortunate, and it happens to too many people, and there's really not a lot that, you can do for these people, and, I've been fortunate, I haven't had to deal with it too much, but it's something a lot of people do have to deal with, so, yeah.
I got this statistic that I didn't, there's a couple of them, and I'm going to read them to you. Besides him winning 6 AFC titles and 2 Super Bowls and having over 300 wins as an owner, him and Giants founder, Tim Arrow, the only 3-decade owners in pro football history to win 60% of their games And for those who are betting people, who like to put the odds in their favor, this is a nice tidbit. The Broncos' 186 home victories are the most in the NFL since the team since Bolin bought the team in 1984, when Elway was his quarterback, and the Broncos' 5 losing seasons during those 30 years are the fewest in the league over that span. So he's got 300 wins, over half of them, almost 200, 14 shy of 200, are home victories, and that's the most in the NFL since he bought the team in 84. For those who are betting people, I'm pretty sure you've been doing it already, because you probably know some close to that statistic, but that's a nice little tidbit to have. When it's like money in the bank when the Broncos play at home. That's good to know. I'm not a betting person like that, so I wouldn't use that to my advantage. But it's a nice piece of information to have. All right, staying in the NFL. On a last note here, I just wish Mr. Bolin well. I hope he lives a long, fruitful life after this. I think he's 70 years old, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's how old he was. Let's see if I can see that. I think they said he was 70 years old. Yes, because he bought the team in 84. He was 40 at the time, and he's at it for 30 years. Quite naturally, he's 70. Okay. All right, let's get to another what do I want to get to here? Let's talk about this. I wouldn't say so-called legend, but a player that was responsible for one of the most iconic plays in Dallas Cowboy history. Who passed away after a long illness this past Tuesday. He was 64, and Jeff, I'm telling you, time flies by. I would never have thought that the person that we're about to talk about was 64 years old. But like I said, time flies by, and let me play this clip, and then we'll talk about the player I'm in question.
This is News 8 at 10.
Well, good evening. I'm John McKay.
And I'm Cynthia Seguera. Thank you for joining us for News 8 at 10.
Cowboys camp begins with the loss of a player who helped bring home a Super Bowl. Just hours ago, the team learned that Robert Newhouse has passed away, surrounded by family. Dale Hansen joins us now. Dale, for Cowboys fans who grew up in the 70s like me, this is a real loss.
Oh, it is, John. I mean, it really is. Robert Newhouse was a little man in a big man's game, but he played very big. A man they called the human bowling ball, and it was said that tackling Robert Newhouse was like tackling a fire hydrant. An outstanding running back in his college days at Houston, a second-round pick by the Cowboys in 73. He played 12 years on a team that was loaded with star players. On most other teams, he would have been even better. He ran for more than 4,700 yards, 31 touchdowns. But most of his 12 years, his job was to block for the Cowboys' great running backs, Calvin Hill and Tony Dorsett, and he did lead the way. Maybe his greatest individual moment, Super Bowl 12 in January of 78, his touchdown pass to Golden Richards clinched that win over Denver, and he was the first running back to throw a touchdown pass in a Super Bowl game. He had a stroke 4 years ago, been dealing with a bad heart for several years, and it finally gave out. Robert Newhouse, dead at 64.
I mean, I played my entire career, and I very seldom did we ever lose games. We're in the playoffs every year, pretty much my whole 12-year career, and it was just enjoyable seeing these guys executing. You know, of course, I think it was a great opportunity they got a chance to play with me.
I think almost every player who played with Robert Newhouse would say exactly that.
His memories will live on.
Thanks a lot, Dale. Hey, hundreds of people are talking about Robert Newhouse on our Facebook page tonight. We invite you to share your own thoughts. Just search WFAA.
equipped with 44-inch thighs. Lead blocker for Tony Dorsett. 44-inch thighs. That's insane. Ran for a career high 930 yards, 4.4 average, and two touchdowns in 75. He finished with a little less than 5,000 yards and a 4.1 average and 31 touchdowns. He was fifth on the Cowboys' all-time rushing list. I'm telling you, when they said it was like tackling a bowling ball, this guy was a physical freak. 44-inch thighs, Jeff. I don't know if you remember Robert Newhouse
in
the 70s, but this guy was no joke to try to deal with playing football. Talk to me.
Yeah, you know, I can't believe I remember him as well as I do because, you know, he was playing for the Cowboys, playing very well for the Cowboys when I first started watching football. And back then, you know, kind of like now, that you saw a lot of the Cowboys. At least they were winning back then, you know, it made more sense.
Yeah.
So you saw a lot of Cowboy games, and he was an excellent blocker, and he was a very good ball carrier also. And his thighs were bigger than Earl Campbell's. You know, he definitely, that was something you noticed. And one season, he had, as fullback, he had over 900 yards. This is back in the 14-game season, because in the mid-70s, the Cowboys didn't have a great halfback. That's why they traded up to draft Tony Dorsett. So, you know, during those years, you know, Newhouse got carries, which now you don't see fullbacks getting carries now. And but he got a fair amount of carries during those years. And they also had Preston Pearson coming out of the backfield, you know, on third down usually. And back then Dallas was the only team in the NFL using a shotgun. Which now almost every team uses it. They were one of the few back then. And, you know, they traded up to get Dorsett. But, you know, Newhouse still carried the ball once in a while, and he was a good blocker for Dorsett. And then eventually they started Ron Springs in the backfield with Dorsett. And, you know, Newhouse finished his career as a backup, which now – a lot of teams don't even have backup fullbacks.
Yeah, you're right.
They might have one on the roster, and if there's an emergency, they'll put in a tight end to back up the fullback. I think – did he work for the Cowboys? I think he stayed
– Yeah, you're right. Yep.
And, you know, he – I think he was considered a, you know, solid guy and a family man, and one of his sons played for the Cardinals, about 10 years ago. He was a backup receiver, but he did play in the league for a couple of years.
Yeah, he was in player relations department where he where he worked closely with players in a variety of roles in their off-field lives. Gil Brandt said that he had no airs about him at all, just a genuine, wonderful, really top-flight guy. I don't know that he was ever late to anything. The guy was just a really good model citizen. Robert Newhouse played for the Cowboys from 72 to 83, was from Texas, and a dying breed of position is the fullback, and he played the fullback. But he was a pretty versatile fullback at that. And let me put it this way: God rest his soul. He was ill for quite a while, and it was his time, and he died, I guess, peacefully in Minnesota. Ironically, he was in Minnesota when he passed away. So, anyway, condolences to the family and friends of Robert Newhouse. And may he rest in peace. Let's move on, because we're staying with the NFL, because there's quite a few things going on in the NFL over the past week. like I said, in the last 24, 48 hours. I'm going to talk to you about this guy. I'm going to read this article, and then we're going to talk about it, Jeff, because I think too many people are making, let me put it this way, I think the media in general is making too much of this. I could be mistaken, but from what I read, the original comment and then the second comment coming out because of his original comment, that Tony Dungy is not getting his just deserve. I think he's getting criticized in the wrong way. And I'm going to read this article, and then we can talk about it from there. Ex-coach opinion on Sam, in quotes, a distraction could legitimize an excuse to discriminate. This is from Jean-Jacques Taylor of ESPNDallas.com, which was dated yesterday. Everyone is entitled to his or her opinion, but when your opinion carries as much weight as Tony Dungy's does, you have to be careful about how you wield it. The harm in what what Dungy has said about Michael Sam lies not in his motivation for saying it, but in the impact it could have on the league, the player, and the players who would follow in Sam's footsteps. Dungy's words and the fact that it was someone as respected as he is who said them served to legitimize one of the excuses teams might have had and might still have for not employing an openly gay player. And that's not going to help the progress that Sam is bravely working to help achieve. A quote from Tony Dungy, "I wouldn't have taken him," Dungy said of Sam. The openly gay linebacker the St. Louis Rams selected in the seventh round of the May's NFL draft at some point in the past 2 months. That's what he said it. "Not because I don't believe Michael Sam should have a chance to play, but I wouldn't want to deal with all of it. It's not going to be totally smooth. Things will happen." Michael Sam isn't letting the Tony Dungy controversy divert his attention from where it should be on the making the Rams. It doesn't really matter when Dungy said what he said to the Tampa Bay Tribune, Ira Kaufman, or even why. The whole thing got consumed Tuesday by he said blizzard that obscured the real issue. And in trying to explain himself, Dungy crystallized the problem at the heart of what he said in the first place. This is a quote from Dungy. "I do not believe Michael Sam's sexual orientation will be a distraction to his teammates or his organization. I do, however, believe that the media attention that comes with it will be a distraction. Unfortunately, we are all seeing this play out now, and I feel badly that my remarks played a role in the distraction." And key word, Jeff, before I go on, is distraction. Dungy should feel badly about the remarks, but he should stop throwing around the word distraction because it's a code for a systematic NFL problem. In the NFL of 2014, every single team is operating at the center of a media circus every time it plays or even practices. The amount of attention NFL teams and players get is ludicrous, and would be even if Sam had never made his announcement or been drafted by the Rams. Teams who coaches and players can handle distractions succeed. Teams whose coaches and players can handle distractions fail. Yet the, I quote, distraction myth persists. And the reason it does is because it's an easy way for power brokers to justify personnel decisions that might want to make for other reasons. You don't want to sign Tim Tebow because you think he's not good enough to play in the NFL, but you're worried about the reaction from his rabid fan base if you say that. Maybe you let it be known, even if it's through back channels, that you're worried about the, I quote, distraction that you don't want your other players having to deal with, all that becomes with Tebow's popularity. It's an accepted part of the NFL culture, but it's a trope that should be outdated. grim-faced front office types and analysts strode around as though they're discussing a disease. Oh, no, you can't risk having, quote, a distraction around when you're about the serious business of trying to win football games. And I'll go through this couple of paragraphs and then we'll go on from here. Hogwash. The New England Patriots managed to hobble through training camp just fine last year, and the distraction brought on by having Tebow in their midst for one summer affected their preparation so greatly that they only won 12 games in the AFC East en route to an appearance in the AFC Championship game. In Sam's case, the silliness carries the stench of bigotry and really has no justification. Michael Sam has not been a distraction to the Rams, who have a good, experienced coaching staff that is managing whatever needs to be managed just fine. The flare referenced Tuesday about the Oprah Winfrey Network reality show really shouldn't have been an issue in the first place, and once it was, Sam and the Rams diffused it deftly. Dungy's words will have no effect on the Rams because the Rams are already good with Sam and all that comes with him. I don't want to read the rest of this, but guys saying that Tony Dungy shouldn't be keep on pushing out the word distraction because that could be used as a code word going forward for teams not to be able to draft someone that is not the norm, like an openly gay player or something else about a player. What's your feelings about this, Jeff?
People have been talking about for years when there's going to be an openly gay player in the NFL, and because there have been gay players. I mean, but none of them were openly gay. They came out later on because, you know, there's about 1,600 players in the NFL, and a group that large is going to be a few gays. Not that there's anything wrong with that, I have to say. So, I'll tell you, I thought the first gay player would be totally different. I didn't think it would be a seventh-round draft pick trying to make a team. I thought it would be a star player coming out because, you know, if you're a star, you know, the coaches aren't going to complain about the distraction. If you're a marginal player, then they will. And I don't know. I thought it would be easier maybe for a guy who'd already been with the team at least a year if he came out. Because let's say if he'd already been with the team a year and he was well-liked, and then he comes out, you know, the other guys would say, well, you know, he's a good guy, and he didn't, you know, do anything, you know, out of the ordinary and whatever. So that's cool. You know what I mean? Because, you know, some guys, you know, I mean, you're a guy, you've been around guys, I've been around guys. That,
sure.
You know, some guys are going to be a little uncomfortable with it, but it'd be a lot easier if it's someone you already knew and you knew was okay. That's just my gut instinct. I didn't think it would be,
well, that's human nature.
You know, a seventh-round pick coming in and he doesn't know anybody on the team and whatever. The thing is, with the distraction, already I think they have, you know, non-sports reporters, you know, covering him with the team, which is not normal for a seventh-round pick. And I heard they were asking him some non-football questions, and he had to cut it short. And, I think it was Mike Golic who said, you know, a guy in his position, you know, trying to make the squad, really's got to focus on football, you know. So I guess he's not giving – hopefully he's not giving out too many interviews. And the thing is, you know, if he's good enough to make the team, I hope he makes the team. If he's not good enough, then, hey, hopefully he got a fair shot. And that's all you could ask for. And the thing is – and then there's the kind of – the gray area. He might end up on the practice squad, which is still good because you got your foot in the door, but it's not as good as being on the active roster. So, but the thing is, I guess him, you know, you got to give a guy credit. He's got guts, and he came out in college, but I'm pretty sure in college he didn't come out beginning of his freshman year, and I don't think there are any problems at Missouri. you know, he's got guts. And, you know, it's going to make it easier for guys in the future.
Well, let me put it this way, Jeff. I think that this was a quote or here we go again. I think it was a response to a question that was asked somewhere close to right after the draft, if I'm not mistaken, that was asked Tony Dungy. But this coming out now. I don't know why it's coming out now, but I think if I'm not mistaken, it was asked to Tony Dungy somewhere close after the draft. And I don't think everyone's trying to, in my opinion, trying to jump on the fact that Tony Dungy's a religious person. He's trying to paint it as him saying that he wouldn't draft Michael Sam basically because of his religious beliefs. Where I think Tony was answering it, and I'm almost positive he was answering it in the context of being a either a football coach or someone that's in the personnel part of a football team, and evaluating the talent of Michael Sam, and saying that he wasn't a draftable player, and it goes without saying that the Rams picked him with a compensatory pick in the last round of the draft, quite a few teams, quite naturally, passed up on him because there was speculation that he was not a draftable type player. So the Rams took a shot, which they do with a lot of players late in the rounds, especially I think with compensatory picks. Took a flyer on a guy to see if he could pan out, and it could have been because they wanted to be the first to draft an openly gay player and also to take a shot on this guy and not leave him twisting in the wind trying to latch on to a team as a free agent, which is harder to do quite naturally because you weren't drafted, regardless of what round, you weren't drafted, and you being a free agent trying to latch on to the team is not an easy thing to do. So I think, and to wrap it all around, I think Tony Dungy was saying this guy, in my opinion, was not a draftable player, and I wouldn't have drafted him, not because of his sexual orientation, but because the ability or inability he have on the football field. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, I think the whole thing about what Dungy said, and I like Tony Dungy. I think a lot of that is just them making a big deal about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, believe me, there's worse things he could have said. It's just, you know, with certain topics, you know, people are ready to jump all over somebody. And the thing is, you know, it's very well known that Tony Dungy's a religious gentleman, and some people just there's a lot of people who automatically like that, but there's also a lot of people who automatically dislike that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they bring up the issue of race.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's similar to the issue of gay rights, but it's not the same. So, and just some people, though, every time it comes up, they always equate the two. They're not identical, and it's not always a valid comparison.
Right. Well, you know, I have an issue with the so-called media, and I was talking about a guy. I was talking to a guy today about the media, not on this subject, but about the media in general. Now, I don't know if we're considered a media, but the major media, I should say. Let me put it that way. And this is regardless of whether it has to do with sports or has to do with politics. And the thing I was saying about that was the media picks on a subject, regardless of what the subject is, whether it's in sports or has something to do with the political landscape, and harps on that one particular subject and tries to drive that subject as public opinion. So when the media says public opinion, it's not necessarily, in my opinion, public opinion. It's the media opinion trying to drive the subject and portray it as public opinion when a bunch of media, and usually when the media starts, they all start jumping on at the same time and riding that train until it can't be ridden anymore, and then use the disguise of public opinion to drive whatever subject that they want to promote or push forward. I don't know how you feel about that, but I've been finding that out a lot, that the media is trying to drive the conversation, and it's not necessarily in public opinion. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, well, we are the media. I guess we're the grassroots media, but mm-hmm. the professional media, a lot of times these people have agendas, which
right.
I don't have a problem with it, but at least be honest about it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because they're human beings, and it's funny because the different segments of the media have their own different agendas, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's some people who are very pro-gay. You know, some of them are gay and some of them aren't, but they, you know, for whatever reasons, they're very much pro-gay, and they bring up that issue and their opinions about it all the time, you know. And you know, but, you know, some people, they'll tell you. They'll say, hey, this is my bias. These are my views. I don't like when people try to pass themselves as off as being neutral, and they're not, you know.
Right.
But, you know, and I'll tell you, you know, some of the worst are the liberals. You know, they
yep.
really are, because a lot of mm-hmm. the conservatives, you know, they'll say, okay, well, these are my views, but you're entitled to your opposing views. And some of the most closed-minded people are the liberals, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's the line? You know, it's a liberal's the worst kind of bigot, you know. And once in a while that comes up, you know. I mean, I remember years ago I worked with a woman who she had, and I, you know, I'm not against gay, but she had this pro-gay agenda. She wasn't gay, but she was just bringing it up at work where it really wasn't appropriate because that's her personal views and whatever, and it's just
mm-hmm.
like, you know, this is work. We got to focus on work. That doesn't have to do with work, you know. And those are the kind of things I avoid at work. But, you know, just for somebody who was always pushing her personal agenda, whatever it was, and that was one of her agendas, you know.
Okay. Well, I just had to get that out there because the fact is I think in my opinion, and I could be off base, but I don't think I am, that the media is trying to drive the negative side of this, meaning have an agenda as saying that Tony Dungy is injecting his religious views against Michael Sam playing in the NFL, when in fact I think maybe he didn't word some of it correctly, but he was basically saying that he didn't think Michael Sam was a draftable player and worth the being drafted because of his football skills didn't warrant it. So I think that's what he was trying to say, even though the media is trying to twist it in a different light and put a religious bias against someone who lives an alternate lifestyle. So I just had to put that out there before we move on to some more football news, which just came out today, and already is in the firestorm for the simple fact is a lot of people don't think he didn't get a just sentence, and I'm pretty sure you know about our fellow local guy basically from New York, Ray Rice draws a 2-game suspension from the NFL. The suspensions levied at the discretion of the commissioner have attracted more notice this year because Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, may be one of the people penalized after he was arrested in March on suspicion of driving while intoxicated. He later had his driver's license suspended for 1 year. The treatment of Irsay will be closely watched by players who want to see how Goodell handles a case involving an owner, one of his bosses. On Thursday, Goodell suspended rights for the team's first two regular season games for violating the league's personal conduct policy. Quite naturally, it stems from Rice's arrest in February after an altercation with the former, now his wife, but former, was his fiancée at the time, Janae Palmer, in an elevator in Atlantic City. Rice was also fined $58,000. He will forfeit nearly $500,000 of his salary. And a quote from Roger Goodell says, as you acknowledged during our meeting, your conduct was unquestionably inconsistent with league policies and the standard of behavior required of everyone who is part of the NFL. This league is an entity that depends on integrity and the confidence of the public, and we simply cannot tolerate conduct that endangers others or reflects negatively on our game. This is particularly true with respect to domestic violence and other forms of violence against women. Rice can appeal his suspension within 3 days. He's not going to do that. He got off lightly, and I think he's not going to even come close to try to appeal that. I got two quotes or two audio clips that I want to play. In fact, it's three audio clips, one from Stephen A. on First Take, one from Skip Bayless about Ray Rice on First Take, and then one from John Harbaugh, the coach who's also in the firestorm because of the comments he made about Ray Rice. I'm going to play them in order. I'm going to Stephen A., then Skip, and then John, and then we'll talk about it, Jeff.
Our Adam Schefter reports that the NFL will suspend Ray Rice for the first two games of the season, per his sources.
Well, that won't help the conversation that we just had.
Yeah, so we are on that conversation, since we were talking about the Ravens. Your reaction to that, Stephen A.?
It was deserved. Anytime you do anything to impugn the integrity of the league, you're going to suffer the consequences. And that is what happened. We don't know all the intricate details about what happened in that elevator with him and his now wife, who was his fiancée at the time. And they both need to be applauded for the fact that they went, sought help, discussed it, worked things out, got married, addressed the media, and they're handling this as a family. Ray Rice, his wife, their parents, etc. We have to applaud that portion.
Sure.
But we don't know the particulars of what happened. What we do know is that we saw him dragging her out of the elevator, that she appeared to be unconscious, and that according to the police report, she was struck.
Mm-hmm.
And by virtue of that alone, in this society that we live in, you have to send a message that that is not something that will neither be condoned nor tolerated. I think that if it had been more than two games, based on what we don't know, based on them working out their personal issues with one another, I think it would have been excessive. But I think a two-game suspension is appropriate because it sends the right message without but so much suffering on the part of Ray Rice's family and that of the Baltimore Ravens. So I think it's fair. Okay.
And it's a response with Skip Bayless.
Video of what happened inside the elevator, and again, I don't know if Roger Goodell and company have seen that, Ravens have seen that, but to me, given the initial outcry over this, this seems like a pretty light sentence to me of only two games.
Yeah.
This is more in the wrist slap area to me. That, like, you think it's
no,
I think it's fair because I didn't go by the initial.
Okay.
I went by the whole thing that we've seen everything unfold in the weeks to follow. Had this decision come down in the immediate aftermath of the report and what we saw, this would have definitely been too light.
Okay, because this was the lightest punishment he could have gotten for what transpired. And again, I don't know exactly what transpired, but clearly the message I'm getting here is not as much transpired as we might have guessed in the beginning.
Is that fair? Yeah, well, you're saying if you believe Roger Goodell and company, I saw what actually happened inside
yes.
the elevator, since we didn't see that.
And that's just speculation on my part, because I don't know if they did or not.
All right, again, Ray Rice suspended for the first two games of the season. That will be against the Bengals and the Steelers.
There are consequences when you make a mistake like that. I stand behind Ray. He's a heck of a guy. He's done everything right since. He makes a mistake, all right? He's going to have to pay a consequence. I think that's good for kids to understand that it works that way. That's how it works. That's how it should be. And we'll move forward, and the next guy will have to step up, and then Ray will be back, you know, when the time comes. So it's not something that we're dwelling on, as you said. We're not worrying about it. We're just moving forward.
All right. That was Jim Harbaugh. But I didn't get the whole audio of that. He did say there are consequences when you make a mistake like that. And then he said, I stand by Ray. He's a heck of a guy. He's done everything right since he's made a mistake. All right, he's going to have to pay consequence. I think that's good for the kids to understand, and it works that way. That's how it works. That's how it should be. But before he said that, the sentence he said before that was not a good John Harbaugh moment, in my opinion. This is his quote. This is a direct quote from John Harbaugh about this. It's not a big deal. It's just part of the process. And then everything I just said before that, he said about there are consequences you make when you make a mistake like that. But what to come out and say it's not a big deal, it's just part of the process, you know, I got a problem with that. Maybe I'm being too picky, but when a head coach, a position of authority, and has a player that's going through the things that Ray Rice has gone through with his wife, and gotten suspended because basically of the domestic violence, and he says it's not a big deal, it's just part of the process. After he said that, I don't think he was thinking about maybe I should clarify that, but maybe that's what he meant. It's not a big deal. That is a problem for me. What about you, Jeff?
Yeah, maybe he misspoke. I mean, I'm a little puzzled by some of this, and I think his suspension, which a lot of people consider lenient, and the reaction, I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, Ray Rice has a clean record, because usually this kind of stuff, I mean, it could be anybody, unfortunately. It's not just something that happens in bad neighborhoods, and I think it's taken people a while to realize that. But, you know, Ray Rice, he's I don't think he's ever been in any kind of trouble. And, I mean, I'm familiar with him because I saw him play in college at Rutgers. He's from New Rochelle, New York. That's not far from New Jersey. That's still in the New York area.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I can't remember him being in any trouble at all in college or as a pro, and I think that's why he's an easy guy to stand by, and he got a light suspension because I, you know, not all, but a lot of guys with that type of thing, they have other problems too. And, you know, I was just very shocked when I saw about, you know, the incident in Atlantic City, but hopefully, you know, he'll put that behind him. So,
well, that's true. But let me ask you this. Just because he's never been in trouble, does that excuse what he did, and does that warrant the two games when the norm for Roger Goodell for a player having an infraction is not two games. It's norm. The norm is like four games and up. Usually the standard when you have done something, it's about four games. It's very rare for a player to get just two games. What's your thoughts on that?
I think, you know, and sometimes even in a court of law, it comes into play if you have a clean record. So because of that, I think, you know, I don't know if it's intentional or it's subconscious, that, Ray Rice is getting a bit of a break. The case of Vincent Chin. I don't know if you remember that, but he was a Chinese-American guy who got beaten to death by, this psychotic, racist, drunk guy. He gets found guilty, and the guy gets a slap on the wrist. He beat him to death with a baseball bat. And the judge, he said, because... The perpetrator had a clean record, yada, yada. He thought it was right to give that very light sentence, and it was ridiculous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that sometimes comes into play. That was the extreme case. But, that comes into play if you have a clean record.
All right. Well, we're going to stay on the NFL side of this. And go to, and I'm trying to figure out which way I want to go here. Let's go with this because I think this guy, who knows when and if this guy is ever going to make it back to the NFL. I'm not talking about Josh Gordon. I'm talking about the other lost cause wide receiver from Jacksonville, Justin Blackmon. I don't know if you heard about this, Jeff. He got arrested for a third time, this time in Edmond, Oklahoma, where police have charged him with possession of marijuana. Edmond Police Department officers stopped Blackmon for a traffic violation and could smell the odor of marijuana coming from his car. They searched his car, and quite naturally they found marijuana and took him into custody. Now, he's already serving an indefinite suspension after his third violation for the NFL's substance abuse policy. And now this is on top of it. Just like the Cleveland Browns have not released Josh Gordon, who's going to, I think he has up until August 1st to appeal his suspension, Justin Blackmon has not been released from the Jacksonville Jaguars. Jaguars owner Shad Khan said he sees no reason for his team to cut ties with Blackmon. We want him to get help he needs. And quite naturally, this is his third arrest and second in Oklahoma. He was arrested in Texas in 2010. He was arrested again in 2012 in Oklahoma after he showed his blood alcohol count to be three times the legal limit. That put him in the substance abuse program. And a quote from the coach right now, all I can say is I'm just praying that he can get help, get the help that he needs. That's from the coach, Gus Bradley. Josh Gordon, Justin Blackmon, two highly talented wide receivers with definite substance abuse issues. Your thoughts on... Should the team keep these guys in hopes of being able to use their talents that they exhibited on the field? That's why they drafted them so high, or drafted them, or got them on their team. Or would they be best served releasing these guys? It's just in case. This is pretty much like a parallel thing with Michael Sam. These guys have very good ability versus Michael Sam. These guys... Michael Sam hasn't been in any trouble, quite naturally, but because these guys have such a high skill set that the teams are holding on to them with dear life, hoping these guys get their acts together. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, they both are very talented. I mean, Josh Gordon really showed that last year, and I think he's suspended, so the Browns don't have to pay him. If they cut him, believe me, someone's going to give him a chance. I mean, he cost himself a lot of money, and he'll have to sign a contract with a lot of clauses that cover the team if he gets in trouble. But when you got as much talent as Josh Gordon, somebody's going to give you a shot. And
sure.
Probably the same with Blackmon. But, and both of those guys were in trouble in college. I mean, And, you know, sometimes if a guy gets in a little trouble in college, you think, you know, boys will be boys, whatever. But I think a lot of teams think this, and there's some truth. And it shows a lack of maturity sometimes. And, you know, is this a guy you want to invest a lot of money in? And both of these guys, you know, they showed immaturity in the NFL. And, you know, I'm sure, I guess it must be hard when, you know, you're a big, strong guy and you're young and everybody's telling you you're terrific and you feel bulletproof and people say, hey, don't mess up because, you know, you could be a high pick, you could make a lot of money, and then they mess up and it costs you money and whatever, and it could cost you more than that. But, you know, it's unfortunate when you see guys with obvious talent who are just wasting it. I mean, there's some things like, personally, I don't see what the big deal is about marijuana, but it shows a lack of maturity because it's still illegal in 48 states.
Sure.
So, you know, don't get busted with it, especially if you're already suspended for something. I mean, that just, you know, total lack of maturity. I mean, do you remember when Michael Vick was waiting to go on trial for the dog fighting? He got busted for, I think it was his urine came up positive for marijuana, and it just, it didn't help his cause, you know?
Nope.
But, hey, that guy paid his dues, and you know what? I give him credit for the most part, staying out of trouble, except for, like, one little incident. So, and believe me, he paid the price for that, so, and you know, I hope people, I think at this point most people are giving him a break, and hopefully he'll, you know, get on with the rest of his life, so.
All right, Jeff, and last but not least.
Absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Michael Robinson, I don't know if anybody listened to the NFL Network, Total Access, but Michael Robinson, who was a former teammate, Marshawn Lynch, said on the air that Marshawn Lynch just called me, we just talked, and he said he will be holding out from training camp this year with the Seattle Seahawks. Marshawn Lynch wants to get paid. It is a 28-year-old running back that has had a lot of carries under his belt and wants to, just like some of the other players from the Seahawks, the world champion Seahawks, wants to get paid, is going to hold out. The only thing I can say before I swing it to Jeff, those fantasy football players that, and if you're an astute fantasy football player, you know, when a player holds out, especially on these skill positions on fantasy football, and especially a running back that's got a lot of carries under his belt and taking a lot of pounding because of his style of play, holds out. If he holds out in training camp and comes back just when the season starts or thereafter, usually does not have a good season. It's always some injury issues that have to flare up. And it would behoove Marshawn Lynch to not hold out because there's a young buck behind him that's dying to get that starting job if Marshawn Lynch doesn't report to camp or decides to hold out for any length of time. I'm talking about Christian Michael. What's your thoughts? Marshawn Lynch deciding to say, I want to get paid, and I think it's in light of what happened with Jamal Charles. Talk to me, Jeff.
Yeah, you know, you can't blame the guy for wanting to make his money because this might be his last big contract. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he's done playing ball, at, you know, when he's retired at 35 and he's broke, everybody say, oh, you should have tried to make some more money, you know. I mean, he's a heck of a football player. You want to talk about a straight-ahead runner. That's his only direction, you know, and he keeps those feet moving. So that's what everybody likes, and that's the best style for the NFL game. The thing is, it is you know, I'm a very conservative drafter in fantasy. I'll take chances late, but not early. And to me, a holdout is a red flag.
Yep.
And there's only one thing worse than a holdout. You know what that is? A rookie holdout. Because at least the veterans, they know what they got to do. You know what I mean? At least they've been, played in the NFL, and hopefully they've played in that system for that team. So they got some idea what kind of shape to be in, et cetera, et cetera. And a rookie holdout is the kiss of death. And that's usually it leads to injuries and a waste of a rookie season. But, you know, I remember, you know, hopefully it also depends how much a camp the guy misses. If he misses a week or two and then he comes in and he's not overweight and he looks good and he gets a little preseason in there, that's okay. Because I remember once I drafted Steven Jackson early after his holdout, but he didn't miss all of camp, so he still had a productive season. And I think Marshall Faulk had one of his best seasons after a holdout. And he wasn't a running back, but Deion Sanders, he never went to almost never went to training camp because he was playing baseball. But the thing is, I mean, Deion Sanders was such a ridiculous athlete. If anybody didn't need training camp, it was him. And that was part of the genius of Deion, because one of the reasons he played baseball, besides the fact he got a lot of notoriety and made money for it, it kept him out of training camp, and he didn't like all that contact in training camp.
Right.
And he proved that he was a great cover corner without camp. But that was one of the reasons he played baseball, was to miss training camp every summer.
I hear you.
But, yeah, it's no doubt a red flag. So I think the holdouts were the holdouts were more common years ago when the salaries weren't as much and the guys had to fight more.
Right.
Remember, when the Bears won the Super Bowl that year, they had two defensive starters who held out the whole season, which that you almost never see anymore.
Yeah, you won't see that, yeah.
But you used to. You used to.
Yeah.
There used to be some really serious NFL holdouts. Yeah.
Sure. All right. We've come to the end of the show. I want to thank everyone for listening that's been on, and hopefully you catch the show that you didn't listen to in the archives. Tune in next week. Believe it or not, a week from this Sunday will be the first preseason game, the NFL Hall of Fame game between the Giants and the Bills. One of the things that we'll be talking about next Thursday will be the Hall of Fame players that are going into the Hall of Fame in 2014, including the first preseason game. Real football. Preseason games are starting off a week from this Sunday. Before you know it, real games will be starting, so we'll be gearing up our thoughts on actual football players that are playing, not what we're talking about now. We're talking about players and the way they'll be playing and how they'll be playing and who's to look for fantasy-wise. With that being said, Jeff, I want to thank you for joining me tonight. I want to thank everyone else for listening. Like I said previously, tune in next week, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, always on a Thursday, where Jeff and I and who else drops in will be on part of the NFSP Crew show. Enjoy the weekend. Tune in on 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday for the FSP show, where Vic and I will be talking about another division in football and what we think their records would be. I think we'll be talking about the NFC West, if I'm not mistaken, this Saturday. And on Sunday, I have a guest that is going to be coming on, a guy named Lance Goodman. He calls himself the NFL Exporter. We're going to be talking about training camps, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time this Sunday morning. So with that being said, Jeff, thank you for joining me. Do you have anything that you want to say before we get the heck out of here?
I just want to mention that Chris Snee retired from the Giants.
Yes.
People might not know him because he worked in the trenches I admit I didn't like when the Giants drafted him because he is Tom Coughlin's son-in-law, but he earned his respect. Got two Super Bowl rings and a couple of Pro Bowls, and good, very solid lineman. Never gives up on a play. Always played hard. You gotta like guys like that. Giants have been trying to rebuild that line through the draft. Hopefully, that starts to work a little bit better this year. Because David Deal retired last year, and he was another key member. Two Super Bowl teams, and I wouldn't be surprised if Snee sticks around as an assistant coach or something like that. And Sidney Rice also retired after a short injury-plagued career, but when that guy was healthy, he was a pretty good receiver. And, it's football time.
That being said, Jeff, thanks for the comments. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll talk again on a week from today. See ya.
Got it.
Yeah. It's Mr. Encore. Fantasy Sports and Politics crew. Yeah. Check. Fantasy Sports and Politics. Ain't no other talk show hot as this. Cover every sport and we get it all right. Log on the site, you can listen tonight. Talk about the game, who in first place. You can even call up, state your own case. Football, b-ball, soccer too. Log on, ain't nobody stopping you. It's Fantasy Sports and Politics crew.